The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached by calling 919-781-1973. And now we return to the January 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This is a 5-Tuesday month, so you get some extra reading this month. And we're going to talk about a very famous guy. Dawn of the Dream is the name of the article. Jeremy Markovich, a very significant writer for Our State magazine, is the author. And an audience at a high school in Rocky Mount got an early preview of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s iconic words, "I have a dream." A long-lost audio tape of that 1962 speech casts new light on the meaning of his famous phrase then and now. If you wanted to know whether the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I have a dream," in a speech well before those words rang out from the steps of Lincoln Memorial, there has long been a way to find out. The evidence is inside a thin, orange, hardcover book in the stacks of Braswell Memorial Library in Rocky Mount. Few people know about it. Even fewer have ever pulled it off of the shelf. It's more of a scrapbook, really. Inside, some Rocky Mountain Telegram articles, a local pastor's letter inviting King to town. "Dear Mike," it begins. A black and white picture of King speaking in the gym at the all-black Booker T. Washington High School. A transcript of everything he said to some 1,800 people gathered there on a clear, crisp night in November 1962. That last item, a typewritten readout with handwritten notes, is actually a clue that something else exists, something bigger. A recording. W. Jason Miller, a professor of English at North Carolina State University, has been researching the influence of the poet Langston Hughes on King. In the fall of 2013, he'd been collecting recordings and transcripts of addresses from across the country when he heard about a transcript of the speech in Rocky Mount. If there was a transcript, he surmised, there had to be an audio. He emailed Tracy Thompson, a research librarian in Rocky Mount. "Yeah," she told him, "we have a transcript, and somebody just dropped off a tape, too." The next day, Miller went to the library. It took 6 more weeks of research for Miller to figure out what to do with the 1.5-millimeter acetate that had been sitting in storage for more than 50 years. The plastic on the reel was cracked, the end of the tape was frayed. The thing that saved it initially was the inscription penciled on the cardboard box that housed it. "Dr. King's speech, November 27, 1962. Please do not erase." The tape had been made by someone sitting in the front row and then stashed away in an attic for 38 years, which helped it survive floods. In 2001, the tape was found, brought into the open, and played, but the audio quality was poor and staticky. Local leaders, with some chagrin, felt that it had lost its value, and they didn't know who could restore it. So the reel was tucked in a closet at the offices of the local school district, where it remained until someone dropped it off at the library. Miller's research led him to George Blood, one of the nation's foremost audio restoration experts. Blood said to drop the tape in the mail, but then Miller told him what was on it. Blood asked him to drive it up from North Carolina instead. When Miller arrived in Philadelphia 2 days later, Blood fed the tape into a machine, adjusted the levels, and pushed play. The audio was still scratchy, but the cadence was familiar. The voice was unmistakable, and the words were almost all discernible. About 51 minutes into the 55-minute speech, King pauses. "And so, my friends of Rocky Mount," he says, "I have a dream tonight." In 1962, nobody seemed to remember the part about the dream. "King presents case for nonviolence," read the headline in the Rocky Mount Telegram. The story didn't mention the dream. The speech was part sermon, part civil rights address, part pep rally. It was invigorating, but the individual words didn't linger. "It's like anything else, you know," says Herman Tillman, who saw the speech in person at age 17. "It just kind of fades away." But King's appearance in Rocky Mount in 1962 changed lives. In the days that follow, people wanted to vote, says Dr. Tolokan Omokunde, a pastor in Oxford who was 15 years old when he met King before the speech, then stuck around for the address. In the days that followed, people wanted to go and press for desegregation. In the days that followed, people would no longer accept mediocrity. In the days that followed, I wanted to be a better student. I wanted to actually preach. I saw myself as being a little bit more important. Same with the rest of the city. After the speech, Okamundi says, it was bad business to be racist. The city didn't change overnight, but the impact was felt. When Booker T. Washington High, home of the Lions, merged with the local white school, home of the Blackbirds, the new integrated school made its mascot the Griffin, a mythical creature with a bird's head and a lion's body. But that integration didn't happen until 1969, 15 years after Brown versus Board of Education ordered it. Tillman's uncle, Rocky Mount's first black police officer, was once barred from arresting white men. He later earned the rank of captain. Tillman himself was denied a promotion at Burlington Mills in 1966. "It'd cause a race riot," his boss told him. "Well, let's have the riot," he remembers thinking. "Don't hold me back for something I'm not guilty of." But rather than agree to small conciliatory gestures, Tillman head out for a bigger change. When a better job opened up at Abbott Laboratories across town, Tillman demanded to be treated equally. Managers agreed. He got the job. After Rocky Mount, King kept traveling. He went to Edenton and continued packing venues around the South. And then in the August 1963 March on Washington, during the final speech from the Lincoln Memorial, King looked up from his prepared notes. "I have a dream," he began. Tillman was listening on the radio. "You know," he thought, "I believe we heard some of that." People in Rocky Mount had been moved by King's speech, but the rediscovery of the tape allowed for a closer examination of his words, how he said them, and why he chose them. Audio makes that kind of analysis possible, whereas a transcript can only take you so far. "If you're a sports fan," Miller says, "it's the difference between the box score and the game." Listening to the speech over and over, Miller did so at least 75 times, can connect dots in a way that reading words cannot. There's anecdotal evidence that King first said, "I have a dream," in a speech in Albany, Georgia, a week and a half before Rocky Mount, but in Albany, the audience was reportedly tired and didn't react to the phrase. In Rocky Mount, they did. There's uproarious applause on the tape as King declares, "I have a dream that one day we will be free." The next year, during his speech in Detroit, "I have a dream" connected with the audience again. The phrase became such a strong set piece in King's speeches that as he came to the end of his prepared remarks during the March on Washington, the singer Mahalia Jackson cried out, Tell them about your dream, Martin. It's unclear if King heard her, but moments later, he put his notes down, looked out at the 250,000 people in front of him, and delivered from memory the most famous portion of his most famous speech. The words are not exactly the same ones he spoke 9 months earlier in Rocky Mount. In that gym, they had more emphasis, more energy. The crowd was closer. On the tape, you can hear King pounding on the podium, his papers rustling. The speech was not a rehearsal for the March on Washington, which wasn't even being planned yet, but rather a testing ground for what worked, what connected, what people, or rather what called people to action. For that, King turned to poetry. The words, "I Have a Dream," were adapted from Langston Hughes' poem, "I Dream a World," rearranged for maximum impact, in a way that's part metaphor, part prophecy, and part poetry. Poetry is where memory breathes, Miller says, so the unforgettability of that phrase goes back to what he's taking from Langston Hughes. Without that, we just have words that come to us and leave as soon as they appear. But with metaphor and with poetry, we have something that remains. The phrase remains because eventually it became a refrain. When King said, "I have a dream," in D.C., it was popular, but it was quickly folded into a larger story of the civil rights struggle and King's successes, Selma, and failures, Chicago. Before his death, King wondered aloud in speeches whether his dream would ever be realized. It wasn't until after his assassination in 1968 that people started to reconnect with the phrase which represented what might have been King's most idealistic, hopeful, and public moment. After a federal holiday was named for him in 1986, portions of the "I Have a Dream" speech were rebroadcast on television every January, a sort of ritual. The sound, the spirit, and the repetition move the words from the brain to the heart. In Rocky Mount, the dream was always there, hidden away in a plastic reel. After the audio was extracted from the magnetic acetate tape, the significance of the tape itself faded into the background. Miller has preserved it in an undisclosed location. It's the message that matters, not the medium. Now anyone can listen to excerpts of the speech online, but Miller's students at North Carolina State find it, honestly, a little depressing. Many of the issues that King spoke about, including voter rights and racism, have become the struggles of a new era and another generation. But in Rocky Mount, the tape has turned "I Have a Dream" into words that can be felt, connected to, and reckoned with. And so, on a cold February night in 2018, people gathered once again in the gymnasium where King had spoken 56 years earlier. The place has barely changed. A riser stood up front, a black curtain hanging behind it. People shuffled in. Rosa Andrews Brody took her seat. She, like a handful of others, had been in the gym for the first speech. "The Lord just put me at this place at that time," she said. Several local officials talked about the legacy of King's visit and the remarkable resurfacing of the tape. Miller gave a hearty thank you to the people of Rocky Mount and to the film crew that was present to record what happened next. The lights lowered, someone pushed play, and for the second time, King's words filled the gymnasium. The audience reacted with joy and laughter. Yes, and applause, just like the first time. And the crowd was brought to its feet by King's conclusion, "Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." That left Herbert Tillman, despite the years, the hindsight, the bad and the good, feeling the same way he had as a teenager in this place decades before. "I love it. I love it. I love it," he said. "If that doesn't inspire you, I don't know what to say." You are listening to our state magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and if you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5138. We go back to the front part of the magazine now in the section How, or rather, We Live Here, Farm Tour. We're going to Burnsville when the cows come home. A couple in Yancey County started farming to connect with their land, but it's their connection with Highland cows that has captured hearts around the world. Written by Katie Shantz. As Emily and Adam Hobson trekked through the forest high on a mountainside on their farm in Burnsville, they began to worry. The ground cover was thick and slippery. Peering through trees and rain, they saw only green in every direction. It was May of 2017, and they knew that one of their cows, Roan Brew, had wandered off to give birth. The Hopkins were used to searching the farm to check up on newborns, sometimes for hours, sometimes in the dark with a flashlight, but this was especially bad weather for a baby. Finally, they spotted them. The little reddish-brown calf was soaked from the rain, and he didn't know how to nurse. Big for a newborn, he may have gotten stuck during birth, depriving him of oxygen and temporarily stunning him. Adam and Emily gave the calf a name, Baby James. Then they waited and watched and patiently tried to teach him to nurse. But they were running out of time, and they knew they had a decision to make. It was time to bring the calf home. Back at their house, they fed him milk through a tube, and he curled up on a dog bed and fell asleep. 3 years earlier, the Yancey County natives had moved onto Emily's family farmland, hoping to become more self-sufficient and to connect with the land. They started by raising chickens, but Emily had always dreamed of having a Scottish Highland cow, a resilient, hardy breed known for its impressive horns and long, fuzzy coat. When a friend called to let her know that one was available right down the road, it felt like fate. The Hobsons gave their farm a name, Happy Hens and Highlands, and Emily immediately started looking for more of the cows she'd fallen in love with. Soon they had 28. The plan was to raise grass-fed beef, but then the babies started being born. That was it, Emily says. We knew we could never part with them. Today, around 200 acres are home to more than 80 Scottish Highlands and Highland Crosses, strictly raised for breeding, to be pasture pets, and to be sold to small hobby farms where their job is to mow the grass in pastures. Since starting the farm, the Hobsons have traveled to more than 30 states to pick up cows and deliver calves to new homes. They've gone camping with diaper-clad calves on cross-country road trips, and they've taken sandy beach strolls with babies. They've explored St. Augustine, Florida, with a cow that curled up at their feet at a dog-friendly restaurant. And they've dealt with fame as the story of Baby James spread around the world. After they brought him inside that first night, the weak calf bonded with their dogs, who gave him a will to live. They really mothered him, Emily says. He'd act like a dog, he'd run with them and headbutt them and try to nurse from their ears. The pictures they posted online were predictably adorable. And although the calf had health complications in his first year of life, the Hobsons never gave up on him. Now Baby James is the unofficial mascot of Happy Hens and Highlands. His likeness can be found on T-shirts, coffee mugs, and bumper stickers. He often makes appearances at festivals, and a local craft beer is named in his honor. His escapades are followed by nearly 130,000 people on Instagram. Baby James doesn't quite fit in the house anymore, and is a little too big to play with his canine friends. But he's right at home in the backyard. We believe we're here to be stewards of the earth, Emily says, to take care of these animals and to love them. It's a picture here, and it says each of the Hobson's cows is given a name, Little Girl, Tiny Tim, Milton, Finnegan, Loretta. This curious one goes by Lady, which is interesting because this cow, who's sort of a tan color, has long horns. And there's a not a tattoo, but a tag attached to one ear. So if he gets lost, they know where it goes. And he got very shaggy hair coming over those, or excuse me, she has very shaggy hair coming over those horns down her face. We could only see one of the eyes because there's so much hair over the other one. And she's just picked up some grass. She was mid-eating, I guess, and it's still hanging out under her chin. Let's go to We Live Here neighborhood and talk about Castle Street. A once empty stretch of road in downtown Wilmington is transformed into an eclectic arts and antiques district. We have a picture here. It says Michael Moore Antiques on it. And a young man and young woman are coming down, taking a look in the window. And its caption says, Shop. Michael Moore Antiques, known as the ambassador of Castle Street for his role in developing the district, Michael Moore has been selling antiques since the 1980s. His store specializes in lamps and light fixtures, but you can also find furniture, toys, and collectibles. Michael Moore had a vision as the longtime owner of an antique store in Wilmington. He imagined a place where businesses like his could come together and flourish, a place where people could stroll between shops with ease, browsing vintage furniture and rare collectibles. So when he got the chance to move his store to Castle Street in 2004, he recognized the opportunity that was before him. The area had been a bustling shopping district in the 1950s and 60s, but malls and shopping centers eventually drew businesses away. By the 1990s, most of the buildings, save for a few early antique stores, stood vacant. Excited by the area's potential, Moore engaged other shop owners to follow him to Castle Street. And they did. Slowly at first, but soon the two blocks between 5th and 7th Street were bursting with new businesses. Today, the area is home not just to antique stores, but restaurants, art galleries, a theater, and a wine shop as well, all full of people exploring the Castle Street Arts and Antiques District that Moore dreamed of. There's pictures here and some more discussion. This says, Shop. Gravity Records. Since opening in 2004, Gravity Records has made a name for itself as an independent music store selling rare vintage and contemporary vinyl. But owner Matt Keene's dedication to music goes beyond records. After moving to Castle Street in 2013, Keene renovated an old storage room in the back of the shop for his live music and other performances. We see him here in short sleeve shirts and his tattooed arms and his jeans and his keys hanging off his belt. He's thumbing through plastic container full of vinyl. And we see vinyl records on the back. Boy, one of them looks familiar to me from the 1960s or 70s, and I can't quite read the title on it. I wish I could recall that. One says Star Wars. Another one says Flash Gordon, Vampire Weekend, Yellow something. It's out of the picture. Somebody and Jay, etc. And there's a guitar hanging on the wall. And what looks to me to be a pretty old-fashioned tuner to bring in radio stations. Jess James and Company, after working in the fashion industry in New York City, local style editor and fashion consultant Jess James opened her shop on Castle Street in 2016, where she hosts fashion shows, style swaps, and trunk shows. Her boutique is filled with her favorite vintage clothing and accessories, as well as antique books and prints. And Eat, RX Restaurant and Bar. Located in the former Hall's Drugstore, RX is dedicated to working with local organic farmers and fishermen. Try one of Chef James Doss's modern southern recipes, like deviled eggs with smoked triggerfish and basil, or enjoy a seasonal elixir or sweet prescription from the cocktail and desserts menu. Shop. Whatever Wilmington, styled as a pop culture curiosity shop, Whatever Wilmington is as much museum as it is store. Browse movie and TV props and memorabilia, comic books, posters, vintage toys, and oddities you never knew existed. They've got a whole section here of three shelves worth of lunchboxes with colorful cartoon characters on the front. Well, this isn't a cartoon character, but one says Indiana Jones. One says The Sands of Iwo Jima, Planet of the Apes, Superpowers, and Space something or other. And I can't read the others, but they all have colorful figures of men or monsters or whatever on them for kids' lunchboxes used long ago. Drink Wilmington wine. Enjoy a glass of wine at Castle Street's only wine shop, either on the quaint back patio or at one of the shop's many events. Owner John Wills, above in the picture, hosts free tastings on Friday nights, as well as live music, arts events, and wine and cheese pairings all year long. This is a classic picture. In fact, I have a cartoon image on a website of mine that is almost this exact picture. He has a cap on. I don't know what kind of a cap you call it. It's not a baseball cap, but it comes forward over his head, and he's looking up at a wine glass that's half full of red wine, and he's holding it up in the air and admiring the color. So it's really a classic image of a wine connoisseur. And lastly, Eat, Jester's Cafe. What started as a coffee shop in 2005 has morphed into one of Castle Street's most beloved restaurants. The cafe is best known for its Sunday brunch, featuring dishes like French toast casserole, which is baked, sliced, and loaded with sweet toppings. And there is a really pretty picture here of somebody dribbling some syrup on what looks like pound cake with sliced strawberries and whipped cream on top. Ooh! Time for an ad before we have to leave you. Asheville Salt Cave. Salt therapy, massage therapy, and salt apothecary. 45 relaxing minutes in our nature-inspired salt cave can be beneficial for respiratory conditions, stress, immunity, skin ailments, and sleep. You can book online at www.ashevillesaltcave.com. Down at the bottom of the page, it says, recharge with self-care. Visit our salt apothecary online and our downtown shop at 12 Eagle Street in downtown Asheville. There's a room that looks like it's filled with sand and beach chairs and big salt structure on the wall. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode and January's magazine, our state magazine, that is. I certainly hope you enjoyed it and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of our state was underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions, comments? Call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.